are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. In the summer of 1965, several Ku Klux Klan members riding in a pickup truck shot two black deputies on patrol in Washington Parish, Louisiana. Deputy O'Neill Moore, the driver of the patrol car and father of four daughters, died instantly. His partner, Creed Rogers, survived and radioed in a description of the vehicle. Less than an hour later, police in Mississippi spotted the truck and arrested its driver, a decorated World War II veteran named Ernest Ray McKelveen. They returned McKelveen to Washington Parish, where he spent 11 days in jail before authorities released him. Afterward, the FBI sent its top inspector to Bogalusa, Louisiana, to participate in the murder inquiry, the only civil rights era FBI investigation into the killing of a black law enforcement officer by the KKK. Despite that assistance, lack of evidence and witnesses unwilling to come forward forced Louisiana prosecutors eventually to drop all charges against McKelveen. The FBI continued its investigation but could not gather enough evidence to file charges, leaving the murder of an O'Neill Moore unsolved. Clan of Devils, the murder of a black Louisiana deputy sheriff, is Stanley Nelson's investigation of this case, which the FBI probed from 1965 to 2016. Nelson describes the Klan's growth and the emergence of black activism in Bogalusa and Washington Parish. Against the backdrop of political and social change in the 1950s and early 1960s. With the assistance of two retired FBI agents who worked the case, Nelson also explores the lives of the primary suspects, all of whom are now dead, and points to the Klansmen most likely responsible for the senseless and horrific attack. The book that we're featuring this evening is Clan of Devils, The Murder of a Black Louisiana Deputy Sheriff, with my special guest, journalist and author, Stanley Nelson. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Stanley Nelson.
Thanks, Dan. Good to be with you.
Thank you very much for this interview. Let me ask you first off how you came to be involved with this book, Clan of Devils. What brought you to this project?
Well, since 2007, I've been working on unsolved murders committed by the Klan in the 1960s, and I live in northeastern Louisiana. I'm located in a Concordia Sentinels located in a little town called Faraday. In this area of northeastern Louisiana and southwest Mississippi, there were multiple incidents of Klan violence, and I began to connect eight murders to a little-known Klan group called the Silver Dollar Group. And over the case, over the period of working on these cases, writing scores of stories over years, I met a number of FBI agents and retired agents who had worked on some of the crimes that I was working on. And over the course of that time, there was one particular retired agent named Ted Gardner who kept mentioning to me the horrendous murder of a black law enforcement officer in Washington Parish, which is in southeastern Louisiana. And if you're familiar with it, with the state, Louisiana is shaped like a boot, and Washington Parish is in the tip top of the toe of the boot, and the only parish in the state that's bordered on two sides by Mississippi. And so he began to talk to me about this murder and how it went down, and he had worked on the case during the 1960s. I also had met came to know another retired agent named Milton Graham, who had also worked on that case. And between those two men, they sort of left me a trail to follow, and that's what I did.
Give us a little bit more of the background. You talk about the proximity to New Orleans that this Vernado is that's involved in this mm-hmm. story as well. Let's talk about just this area and the population and some background on this area before we start.
Okay, so this is an area of a lot of forest, and Washington Parish, the county seat or the parish seat is Franklinton, and about the center of the parish, and the biggest town is Bogalusa, which is along the Pearl River on the eastern side of the parish. Bogalusa was founded in the early 1900s by the Goodyear brothers, the tire makers, who bought vast acreage of forest in both Louisiana and Mississippi and built what was the largest sawmill in the parish in the early 1900s. And that sawmill and that industry by over the 1930s and 40s morphed into a paper mill. And the paper right. mill became one of the largest employers in the parish. And Washington Parish is also a big dairy parish and had a huge income. A lot of people worked in the dairy industry. So Washington Parish is not far from New Orleans. During World War II, when so many men were away in war, Louisiana became, the parishes became homes to a lot of gambling and prostitution activities, and that was particularly true in Washington Parish. This was the result of work by the mob in New Orleans, the Carlos Marcello mob, who paid off sheriffs in some cases and operated houses of prostitution and lots of gambling. So consequently, you had lots of violence that's always associated with those type of activities. In the late 1940s, a man named Dorman Crow, who was a young man, he was a son of a logger employed by the very industry that the Goodyear brothers brought to life there. Mm-hmm. He decided that he wanted to throw his hat into the ring and run for sheriff. He went around the parish. He promised to do away with the gambling and prostitution influence, to run the mob back to New Orleans. And he won. He beat a two-term incumbent. His first two re-election bids, he was elected by huge margins. By the mid-1950s came the Brown versus Board of Education, which in the U.S. was a big case that basically called for the integration of public schools. Mm-hmm. As a consequence of that, we saw a rise of white segregationists in an organization known as the White Citizens Council. And the Citizens Council were determined to stop integration at all costs and keep things just as they were. Mm-hmm. And this occurred in the 50s in Washington Parish. There was a big white citizen council that was born in Bogalusa and spread across the parish. And they decided that the sheriff was too friendly to black people. And the fact was the sheriff, Dorman Crow, had always received good black support. And there were about 1,800 black voters in the parish at that time. And what the white citizens council decided to do is, in order to beat the sheriff, we're going to have to remove some black voters from the rolls. And a man named Ernest Ray McElvin from Bogalusa was a white citizen council member, and he helped lead the effort to purge black voters from the rolls. And this was particularly designed for the 1960 election, when what became the Klan ran its own candidate. And so by the time that election came around in 1960, McElvin and others had successfully removed about 85% of the black voters from the rolls.
Wow.
And it looked very likely that they were going to beat the sheriff. But the sheriff was a fighter, and he went out and campaigned hard. And when the results came in, he won by 137 votes, which astounded the segregationists. They could not believe that happened. About 2 days after that election, a federal judge, in response to a lawsuit that had been filed by the Justice Department, ordered that all of those black voters removed from the polls be from the voting rolls to be put back on them. So all those votes were restored, but 2 days after the election. And so what happened next in Louisiana, particularly in early in 1960, late 1960, a Klan group was formed in the Shreveport-Bossier area, which is in the northwestern part of the state. And that Klan became known as the Original Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. And their constitution and one of their leaders had been a member of the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan from the 19-teens and 1920s, which by some accounts had 4 million members, according to
wow.
some accounts. And you might have, many folks have seen pictures of these huge Klan marches through Washington, D.C.
Yes.
with everybody in their robes. That's from that era.
Mm-hmm.
And so one member, one man that was a member of that original group of Klan, he helped form the Original Knights, and that Original Knights swept through Louisiana, went into Mississippi, and later morphed into the White Knights in Mississippi, which was responsible for the killing of the 3 civil rights workers in Philadelphia, Mississippi in 1964. And so Bogalusa and Washington Parish became, in Louisiana, the home of the largest percentage of Klansmen anywhere in the state. And their whole focus soon became that we are going, and keep in mind that during this election in 1963, the election was 64, but the campaign began in 63, all of the talk in the U.S. was centered on Congress and talk of passage of the Civil Rights, what became the Civil Rights Act of 1964. There was talk in late that year of 63 of freedom riders coming into Mississippi. So the Klan in Bogalusa and Washington Parish determined that we're going to run our same man against the sheriff, and we're not going to be able to remove the black voters. We tried that before, and that didn't work. And it became one of the most bitter elections in the history of Washington Parish. It did not look well for the sheriff in the first round. His main challenger almost beat him, but there was a third candidate, and it threw it into a runoff. And they went to the polls, and on election day, huge turnout, absolutely a massive turnout, lines in Bogalusa. And when the votes were counted, the sheriff had won by one less vote than he did in 1960. He won by 136 votes. And the Klan was absolutely, absolutely furious, because actually what they had done is they had run candidates, Klan candidates, for every office in the parish. Their goal was to take over the parish, but the one position that they wanted more than any other position was sheriff. Sheriff in Louisiana, particularly at that time, was particularly, particularly strong. And the Klan felt that if we can take over as sheriff, then we'll have control of law enforcement. We will be able to run the civil rights agitators out of town. We'll be able to extinguish any local efforts for civil rights. We will maintain segregation and therefore maintain white supremacy. But that goal was dashed when Crow defeated their candidate in January of 1964. And so now the Klan had to look at another way to fight.
What does Sheriff Crow do in response, as a result of the election, and who does he decide to hire and why?
Well, herein lies the matter right here. The Klan had heard that during the campaign for 64, that Crow had made a promise to black voters that if they helped him win re-election, that he would name 2 black deputies. The Klan thought it was a big joke, but it wasn't a joke. Crow had gone to the black community, and he said, "Indeed, support me again." And Crow was a kind of fellow. He could see that times were changing. He could see that blacks were going to have a role in government and things were going to change. And he realized that two black officers, particularly in patrolling black communities in the parish, would serve a good purpose. The black community would be better satisfied with that. And it's the way it usually started when black officers were hired for the first time. Well, Klan heard these stories that the sheriff would do this, but they really did not believe that he would. But when his fifth term began in the summer of 64, he did just exactly what he promised the white community, and he hired two black deputies. He was given a list of five people recommended by the black community. He interviewed those candidates, and he chose O'Neill Moore, early 30s, father of four daughters, wife Mavella, who's still alive and enjoying a good, enjoying healthy and doing well in Washington Parish, and Creed Rogers, who was in his early 40s, married and had one son who was older. Those men began their job on June 1, 1964, and when they took that job, the Klan was absolutely just furious and vowed revenge. And it wouldn't take long for a few things to happen in which really things would go from bad to worse. But the two deputies began their jobs were basically liked by many people in the white community, and the sheriff was proud of the way they were working. And so here's what happened, basically, is about a month, the one thing that the Klan did not want was, and the thing that they feared, because to understand how this rocked their world, they realized that when two black deputies were hired, that badge that they wore, that behind that badge carried the full authority of the laws, local laws and the laws of the United States. And they realized that now a black man, for the first time ever in their lives, now had the authority to arrest a white person that did something wrong. And this was something that the Klan had a hard, difficult, in fact, not only could they not stand the thought of it, they vowed that this was not going to happen. So immediately after those deputies began their work, in all of the Klan meeting houses, which were called claverns across the parish, all the talk began, what are we going to do about these deputies? What are we going to do about these deputies? And then about a month later, the furor grew even greater when O'Neill Moore and Creed Rogers were traveling down a road one night on patrol when they were jolted when another car bumped them in the back. And both cars stopped. They got out. And it was a white man in the other car, and he was intoxicated, heavily intoxicated. No way that he could drive that car. He was a danger to society. They radioed in that they had this white man, and they were told to bring this man to jail. They brought him to the county, to the parish jail in Franklinton. The man was arrested. This was his third DWI, driving while intoxicated, although he had been pulled over multiple times and not given a ticket. And as a consequence of his record, he was sent to the state prison in Angola. And so now you have a case where a white man, what's the biggest Klan fear? That authority of the law, these black men, and now a white man who was a relative and friend to several Klansmen. Now he is in jail because of what a black man did. Right. And that's when the determination became even greater that they were going to get those deputies.
Mm-hmm. Let's use this opportunity to stop for a second for these commercials. Now, you talked about that was the seemingly catalyst for these people, for these Klansmen here. So what happens in just before this June 1st, given the climate that's going on? You talk about a meeting just before that with officials, city officials.
Yes, well, this comes a little bit later. Let me take you through that. So during the course of their first year on the job, the Klan is constantly plotting. They harassed the deputies a couple of times. An agent with the Louisiana Wildlife and Fisheries Department threatens to give them a ticket when he finds them one night on the side of the road, out off the road in the distance, target shooting with a can. Just shooting into this can, and he accuses them of night hunting. He does not arrest him, but the deputies go and tell the sheriff what's happened. And the sheriff is infuriated. He writes to the head of the Louisiana Department of Wildlife and Fisheries and demands that that agent be sent out of the parish to someplace else. And the significance of the agent, his name was Levert Strahan, was that Levert Strahan was a Klan official in Washington Parish. So things continue. We now have passed the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And now the thing to do is, how do we get implementation of that act? How is it now enforced by the federal government? So during early 1965, the local civil rights groups, with help from the Congress for Racial Equality and some other civil rights groups, began to hold marches throughout the spring of winter and spring of 65. Things are very, very tense in Bogalusa. There's a lot of fighting, Klansmen on the streets attacking marchers just for no reason whatsoever. The violence is continuing to grow. And among the things that the activists, civil rights workers, demanded was that the city begin to enforce the Civil Rights Act of 1964. In other words, hire black people for city jobs, enforce the law that black people can go into restaurants and sit at the counter and order something to eat, that the police in Bogalusa quit harassing black people, and just multiple really very simple things. But back then they were huge things. Right. The mayor and the city council continued to deny these things until May of 64, when about mid-May, May of 65, about midpoint of that month, he agrees to the demands. And the mayor has been influenced by Governor John McKithen. McKithen was elected in January of 64, at the same time Crow was elected to his fifth term. McKithen had run as a segregationist, but he soon became a moderate on race, and he soon began to realize that Bogalusa was nothing but a powder keg, and the only thing standing in the way of Bogalusa and Washington Parish following the law was the Ku Klux Klan. He knew how the Klan was. McKithen was from North Louisiana. He knew that he had to do something because he feared all-out war in Bogalusa, and he feared the loss of lives. So McKithen does something that really nobody ever knew about it until, I began researching this book and found some documents from the FBI files that was really quite stunning. Publicly, McKithen had after the, he would later say that he had a secret meeting in Bogalusa, but he would not reveal what happened. But what he had done was he decided that I've got to go talk to some Klan leaders. I've got to get them off the streets, and I got to demand it. So he goes to Bogalusa about the in late May, May 30, 31 of 65, and he goes to the home of a Klansman who just incidentally lives next door to his mortal enemy, the sheriff. And he goes out there, and there's Klan leaders there, and McKithen says to them, "You're going to have to get off the streets of Bogalusa. I'm going to demand that you do that. You're going to have to let this play out." And he told him that he supported the Bogalusa mayor in accepting the demands of the black community. And he also, the Klan had immediately, once the mayor had accepted those demands, the Klan began a recall petition against the mayor. And the governor said, "Stop that recall petition and get off the streets of Bogalusa." The Klan had one demand of McKithen to do it, and their demand was this: you get that white man out of jail that was put there in the state pen because of those two black deputies, and McKiffin refused to do it.
Right.
So he thought, when he left, however, that most of them eventually agreed that they would do that, and he thought that he had gotten through to them. And then 48 hours later, O'Neill Moore and Creed Rogers begin their final ride together through Washington Parish.
Take us through that final ride that happens June 2nd, 1965, and the patrol car,
well,
as you write, easing through town.
Yes. Well, so the way the deputies worked, there was one when the sheriff was reelected for that fifth term and he hired the two black deputies, he bought a patrol car for them to share. And they rode on patrol together. So 1 week, one deputy would keep the car at his house, and he would be the driver. And the next week, the other deputy would be the driver. And it just so happens that on Wednesday night, June 2, 1965, that it was O'Neill Moore's week to drive. So late that afternoon, 3 or 4 o'clock, they begin their shift. O'Neill goes and picks up Creed Rogers. So it's sort of a routine night. They drive to Bogalusa. They go to the substation there, the sheriff's office substation. Check in there. They go to Franklinton, the county seat where the courthouse is. They check in there, do a little work there, and then they decide to go on and make their night patrol. So they patrol up through the north end of the parish and then turn east to a little town called Angie. And Angie is in the northeastern corner of the parish. Below Angie, south 5 miles, is a little town called Varnadoe where the two deputies live. And 6 miles below that is Bogalusa, the largest town in the parish. So it is about 10 o'clock or so at night, a little later, and O'Neill and Creed are going to go to O'Neill's house where Mavella is cooking them a catfish supper. They're going to take their break to eat something. And they're both hungry and looking forward to that. But as they turn and head south at Angie, they notice kind of suddenly there's this black pickup behind them. There's nothing menacing about the truck. It just sort of seems to come out of nowhere. And as they're traveling, they look to their left, to the east, and they see looks like a trash fire or debris fire. They drive past the fire, but Creed says to O'Neill, why don't we turn around and look, make sure that fire's not going to get out of control. So they slow down to a stop, and that truck slows down to a stop behind them, but slowly goes around them. And as it goes around, both deputies sort of lean over and look, and all they can see is the outline of the driver. And they don't have, they don't see anyone else. They can't really see what the driver's face looks like. They can just see that outline. Don't think anything about it, but they do observe that the driver goes ahead a little ways and just sort of goes at a snail's pace. They turn around and drive back to where the fire was a couple of hundred yards, look it over, see there's nothing, it doesn't look like it's going to spread, that it's contained. So they get back in the car, and the truck, they can still see it up ahead, so they speed on up. And as they're about a mile or so outside of Angie, they pass the truck. And when they pass the truck again, Creed Rogers, who's on the passenger side, looks over. And again, all he can see is this very dim outline of a driver. And it appears to be a white male, but he can't tell much more than that. He doesn't see anybody else. Mm-hmm. They pass the truck, and as they get to Varnadoe, O'Neill puts on his left blinker to turn east into Varnadoe on Main Street. He does that. They turn east, and just a block or two, they come to the railroad tracks, that go the double set of railroad tracks, and they notice that that truck has turned as well and is now right behind them. They're going about 25 miles an hour. All of a sudden, they hear this boom. And O'Neill's immediate response is, hey, is our vehicle backfired? And Creed, at the sound of that boom, sees this big hole in the dashboard.
Right.
He says, no, somebody's shooting. Speed up. O'Neill floors it. And when he does that, there's just volley of gunfire. That truck lights up like a Christmas tree. I mean, it's just light, just fire, all fire. O'Neill is shot and killed instantly. He takes a devastating shot to the head. He loses control of the car, and it crashes into a oak tree on the right side of the road. Creed is shot in the shoulder, Creed Rogers, and he sees that the car is going to crash. He tries to brace himself, but the crash is so hard, his head actually breaks out the window on that side of the patrol car.
Mm-hmm.
He essentially will lose his right eye as a result of that crash. He is sitting there. O'Neill has slumped over onto him, and he can tell that he's dead. He is dazed. O'Neill is dazed for a few minutes, and then he eventually picks up the radio, and he calls to the dispatcher. Been shot up in Varnado, he says, we need help bad. Immediately, the dispatcher contacts other officers. The FBI is notified, and just quickly, that town fills up with policemen. O'Neill provides a description of that pickup, and it becomes really one of the most crucial things of the case. And he is able to, he has seen that truck as it passes while they're shooting, so he has seen that truck, gotten a pretty good look at it three times. And he offers this description. He says, it's a dark colored pickup, maybe black, maybe green, maybe blue, I can't tell. It's an old mid-model Chevrolet pickup. It's got a white grill on the top. It has sideboards on the back. And sideboards are these boards that people will put on the back of a pickup so you can have a higher load if you got to load something up, if you have animals to put back there to keep them from falling out. And it was these sideboards that were somewhat small, 6 to 8 inches high on both sides. And then he gives one other clue. He says that there is a rebel flag emblem, license plate, on the front of the grill to the right of center. And that right of center will become a very, very key description. About an hour later, in Tylertown, Mississippi, two officers are sitting in the car together. They had gotten this all points bulletin. They're sitting there, and all of a sudden, this black pickup truck comes storming through town. They estimate 65, 70 miles an hour. It runs a stop sign. They pull it over. Man comes out of the truck, identifies himself as Ernest Ray McElvin of Bogalusa. The man that, you know, you might recall in prior to the 1960 election had led the purge of black voters in Washington Parish.
Mm-hmm.
They take him to the Tylertown jail. He will not talk. He says only a few basic things. The one thing that the officers noted immediately is the one thing missing are the sideboards on the truck. They asked McElvin about his sideboards, and he won't answer. He won't say anything about the sideboards. He says, I've been to a secret meeting. That's all he will say. The officers, of course, they're waiting for the FBI to come. The Mississippi Highway Safety Patrol is there. State troopers from Louisiana come. But while they are holding McElvin in the cell, they hear him throw up three times, and they hear him washes his hands and arms three times. So that if there's any gunpowder anyway, he probably has washed all of that away.
Sure.
They hold him. Sheriff Crow, a day or two later, comes from Washington Parish with a murder warrant for his arrest, take him to Franklinton and books him in the jail there, where McElvin is held altogether in jail for 11 days before he's released.
Let's talk about the two witnesses, and you say the two only witnesses, and one's Daniel Scraps Fornia, a 48-year-old teacher at Varnado High. What does he see? And then talk about the other witness, housewife Jessie Thigpen, and what she saw.
Mm-hmm. Well, both of them saw, they had different, slightly different angles, but they were both on the east side. On the, as the truck was and the car were kept traveling down the road, they were on the left side of the vehicles. Scraps 48 sees the truck, sees the car, but does not see the shooters. He sees some, a little bit of fire, but he cannot see the person. Miss Jessie Bell Thigpen, who lives not far from where Daniel Fournier is, Scraps is, she sees it from a slightly different angle. She sees both vehicles as well. But it's very dark. There are very few street lights. She hears the gunfire. She hears the car wreck into the oak tree. She sees a tire mounted on the left side of the truck, right behind the driver's side. And indeed, McElvin's truck did have that on there. But they cannot identify seeing any person. The problem that would develop through the years would be that, and in the prosecution of the case, among many things, but one very simple thing would be that Creed Rogers could not specifically identify McElvin as having been the driver. But the interesting thing is that when the FBI began its investigation, they went looking for every black truck, dark-colored truck in Louisiana and Mississippi, and they eventually found 200 that matched the general description of the truck. There were similarities to McElvin's truck. Some did have sideboards on them, white grills. Some had white grills. But there was one very distinctive thing, one key thing that Creed Rogers had said, had described, and that was that the Confederate flag license plate was to the right of center, and that was only on one truck the FBI discovered, and that was on Ray McElvin's truck. So that was another key thing. The problem with the case would be, among other things, that none of the eyewitnesses, the two eyewitnesses, could not state specifically for sure that that was Ray McElvin's truck. They could not even make out sideboards because of the distance from which they were from where it happened. So that was one problem. Creed Rogers could not specifically identify Ray McElvin as the driver. And so the district attorney had a real problem. He did form a grand jury, but he didn't have anything to bring to a grand jury. And one thing, another problem was that Creed Rogers was seriously injured, and it would be quite some time before he could testify before a grand jury. So those were some of the initial problems. And then, of course, as the FBI goes out and begins to search for suspects and criminals and people involved in the case, it became very apparent to them that everybody was scared to death. Black witnesses, black people were afraid to talk. White people were afraid to talk. They found one man along the route, the escape route of the truck, who said that very night, passing by his house about 10:30 or so, just minutes after this crime occurred, that he saw Ray McElvin's truck pass. The FBI asked him, well, how are you sure that it's McElvin's truck? And the man said, well, about a month or two earlier, McElvin had had a tire issue with his car, with his truck right by my house, and I walked down there while he was working on it. I'd seen that truck multiple times, and he said, look, I know that truck. That's the truck I saw that night. The FBI will say things like, well, we might need your testimony, and people would constantly say, oh, no, I'm not testifying against the Klan. Are you crazy? They'll kill all my family. And the FBI, but soon in their teletypes to headquarters in Washington, D.C., would tell J. Edgar Hoover and all the people working on the case up there that, look, the Klan has taken a strong stance against the government here, and people are afraid to say anything. And that would be just a major, major problem for the FBI.
Let's use this as an opportunity, Stanley, to stop to hear from our sponsor, which is Ritual. Gaps in the diet shouldn't be ignored. Over 90%, 7% of women aged 19 to 50 are not getting enough vitamin D from their diet, and 95% are not getting their recommended daily intake of key omega-3s. Ritual's Essential for Women Plus multivitamin was formulated by exhaustive research to help fill nutrient gaps in the diets of women ages 18 plus. It is formulated with nutrients to help support brain health, bone health, blood health, and provide antioxidant support. But Ritual didn't stop there. They invested in a gold standard university-led clinical trial to prove the impact of Essential for Women 18 plus multivitamin. The results: Essential for Women 18 plus was shown to increase vitamin D levels by 43% and omega-3 DHA levels by 41% in 12 weeks. My wife Lisa started taking Ritual's Essential for Women 18 plus multivitamin over 2 years ago. She was impressed with how taking the multivitamin made her feel. I decided to take Ritual Essential for Men 50 plus after hearing her reports. And it's been almost a year now, and I'm convinced that Ritual has made a significant difference in the way I feel every day. Right now, Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off their first 3 months. Visit ritual.com/murder and turn healthy habits into a ritual. That's 10% off at ritual.com/murder. Now, Stanley, we were talking about that McKelvin is arrested, Ray McKelvin, McKelveen is arrested. What we didn't mention is some of the evidence, some of the interesting things that were found in his truck. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, they found a couple of pistols in his truck. They found, probably the most significant thing that they found in his truck was a clip for an M1 Tanker Garand. It's a military-style rifle, heavy-duty rifle, high-powered rifle. The FBI would come to believe, based on they were able to determine that both Moore and Rogers and the vehicle had been shot up from slugs from a shotgun and from a high-powered rifle, which they felt could have been a Tanker M1 Garand. Ray McElman was a military war veteran of World War II. He was shot and wounded at Saipan during the war, thought he was going to die, but a man came and rescued him and saved his life. So that was always an interest in him, but they couldn't take it any farther. The other thing, they found one fingerprint on his pickup truck that wasn't his, but through the years, through 51 years, they were never able to identify who that print belonged to, even though they tried really hard. So the main takeaway from McKelvin's pickup was they didn't find anything other than that one fingerprint, but they did find that clip for a Tanker M1 Garand.
It's interesting that they did find a Citizens Council of Greater New Orleans. You talk about the Citizens Council. Mm-hmm. A National States Right Party card and NRA, but also, very interestingly, also a special deputy for the Louisiana State Police, effective November 8th, 1962.
Yes, and those type of things, they had those in Mississippi too, were mostly political things that somebody from the local level could, a representative or some other official could ask somebody that knew the governor, would you give him one of these cards? Say, you know, I guess they were sought after by some people, but they really didn't have any power. And it's hard to tell if a governor, and McKiffin was not governor at that time. In fact, Jimmy Davis was governor at the time. So it's hard to know if that had any specific meaning or not.
Tell us what the national FBI response is to the shooting of these deputies.
Well, there were there were two fronts there. One is just the fact that they were wrapped up in multiple cases at this time, that they responded really strongly, and it was also an extra emphasis because these were law enforcement officers that were attacked. And that seemed to be of special interest to really even the local law people. You know, they still felt that was one of their own, even though maybe not, they didn't feel as strongly as the FBI did. So many of the agents that were there on the ground, many of them arrived that next day. The FBI set up a headquarters at a local hotel. They brought in Joe Sullivan, who was a very famous FBI inspector that helped run the investigation into the murder of the three civil rights workers in Philadelphia, Mississippi, in 64. And the Justice Department sent John Doerr, who was head of the Civil Rights Division, and Doerr also was involved in those big Mississippi cases and the prosecution of those. Right. Both of those men were sent to the streets. As I mentioned earlier, Governor McKiffin was concerned of violence taking hold and being seriously getting out of control in Bogalusa. And, of course, once those deputies were attacked, that happened. The blacks were outraged. Civil rights organizations from across the country came. Klansmen turned out. Segregationists turned out. And just day after day in Bogalusa, it was just a mess. Doerr and Sullivan one day was on the streets, and he saw local Bogalusa policemen just standing, watching, and laughing as white men would run from a sidewalk into the crowd of marchers and just knock somebody down. In fact, he berated the officers for that. Doerr saw this too, and Doerr also saw that blacks could not go into white restaurants and order all these things that a year earlier the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was supposed to bring.
Right.
So he took advantage of a couple of local suits from black activists that had been filed, and Doerr decided that. And McKiffin, the governor, had a month or so earlier embraced this idea. Doerr said, well, Bogalusa is just going to have to be our test on whether the Civil Rights Act of 1964 has any teeth or not. And so he went and filed, federal government filed a lawsuit against the original Knights of the Ku Klux Klan and sought and had injunctions against them on not interfering with free marches, not trying to intimidate people from going into blacks from going into white restaurants, and all the multiple things that the Klan was doing to intimidate the public. So this became the major test case of whether the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was going to have any meaning and would also be a signal to other communities across the South, particularly in what you're going to be required to do. So he filed that suit in July of 65, and by September it came to court in New Orleans, the Fifth Circuit, and the U.S. government won. And the three-judge panel began to institute these rules. They were holding civil city officials would be held in contempt if this act was not enforced, that integration didn't begin in public facilities. And so it was a victory. But the other key victory for the FBI that maybe few people realized was the FBI was able to lean on a couple of the head Klan leaders and force them to provide the court with a list of Klan members. And it was a list of about 150 names. And that list devastated a lot of Klan members, and it also did one other thing. For months and months and months since its inception, the Klan leaders had been telling its members, do not talk to the FBI, do not tell them anything that we do here. You keep your mouth shut, do not identify another member of the Klan. If you do, you'll be drummed out of the Klan and you may be hurt. And so now, an average Klansman is sitting there, well, you know, what in the world? Our Klan leaders just divulge our name. And it caused great dissension within the Klan. And consequently, as a result of that, the FBI was able to develop some really good informants that helped them figure out who the main suspects were and got a good feeling of kind of what happened and how this murder went down.
You talk about that that was a factor that produced informants, but also you mentioned that the idea of people that were considered too renegade or too radical for the Klan, a lot of these, when people spoke of the violence that was planned or that they had in their minds, a lot of these people weren't prepared to go that far with their membership in the Klan.
Yes. Yes. Well, the Klan is always made up of a few different types of people and with different motives. First of all, you know, when the original Knights were formed in 1960 in Louisiana, they were formed supposedly as a political organization designed to stop integration. The robes were symbolic, you know, but we have to sell robes because the Klan has to make money, so members are required to buy a robe. You're required to pay dues. You're required to pay an initiation fee. Well, among the three founders of the original Knights in Louisiana was a dry cleaner from Shreveport named John Swenson. Well, guess who made the robes and made the profit from the robes? So the money was always a big issue in the Klan. The other thing was you always had this violent core that wanted to do violent things. When a good number of Klansmen, men became Klansmen because when they saw things like James Meredith be enrolled at Ole Miss, the thought was, well, look, our congressmen, our senators, our leaders can't stop it. I guess we're going to have to do it ourselves. So the Klan was attracted to a lot of white men, that this is the way we can stop it. But most of those white men were not violent men and didn't necessarily believe in violence, even though they were in an organization that promoted it. And what you had happen by 63, you had sort of a purge of the Klan in that the violent members began to take over, so that by 64, mostly violent men were involved. And a few, just say, regular Klansmen with no violent intent, personally, when this trial happened in September of 65 in the Fifth Circuit in New Orleans, when this trial revealed everybody's name, you saw another mass exodus from the Klan, so that all you were left with were these real hardcore criminal-minded men.
You write about that the informants told of the organization and all of and potential members that and possible potential suspects were formed at that time. Tell us some of these suspects that were found to be by the FBI, and also about Saxon Farmer, the guy that lived right across from Sheriff Crow.
Well, so what I did in going through the FBI files, and we had those files had never been released before, and not in bulk, and the only files that had been released were heavily redacted. And so when I got involved and interested in this case, I asked the Center for Investigative Reporting in California, who I'd worked with before. We began to talk about how we can get these documents. It takes a long time for the Freedom of Information Act to get documents like these. I've been going through this for years, and you wait literally for years to get documents in. So I said, why don't we file suit against the Justice Department because we had tried multiple means before. They had rejected our FOIA request on getting, you know, unredacted files. We were able to get O'Neill Moore's widow, Mavella Moore, signed a privacy waiver, which is one thing that the government officer said, well, there's a lot of private things that hurts the families. Well, when we got that waiver, Ms. O'Neill, Ms. Mavella wanted those files released. And so when we went to court in federal court in San Francisco, and we argued that this was an importance to the public to know what these files say, that it's important to justice, and it's been a long, long time. The case has been closed. It was closed in 2016. There would be no reason not to release it in a timely, fast manner. And the judge ruled in our favor, and shortly thereafter we began receiving monthly document drops from the Justice Department. And as I began to review those files month after month after month, we clearly could sort of pick out the main suspects. And among those was a guy named Saxon Farmer, who was a very violent man in Bogalusa. He ran he owned some gas stations. He was a real proponent of violence, and they found one informant who was also a suspect himself. Well, he wasn't really an informant. He was a Klansman and a suspect who said that about a short time before the deputies were shot and O'Neill Moore was killed, that Saxon Farmer had said that we're going to get them, two N-words, you know, we're going to get them. And a short time after that, they did get them. So Saxon Farmer was certainly a suspect. Another key suspect out of Bogalusa was a man named Rester, who was the city attorney from Bogalusa and a member of the Klan during that time. And Rester would tip off Klansmen over permits that were being sought from civil rights workers or groups to have marches and stuff. He would be alerting them as to who it was and when all of these things would be happening. Rester, later in his life, became an alcoholic, and the FBI actually had tapes of him confessing that he was in the truck and involved in the shooting. Rester is taken before a grand jury, as others are, in the 1990s, but nothing comes out of it. Why they couldn't prosecute Rester remains a mystery to me. It was a Justice Department decision, not a FBI decision. You had instances like this man confessed. There was a man named Elmo Breeland who told people in North Carolina, he was a commercial painter, that he was involved in the murder of a black man, black law enforcement officer in Washington Parish. The FBI determined that he obviously had knowledge, but the Justice Department didn't feel that they could prosecute him. And then you had the most interesting thing to me of all, were the widows or the ex-wives of Klansmen. And I tell one story in the book, and it's just absolutely fascinating, was there was a couple named John and Irene Birch. And Mr. Birch was in the Klan at that time, in Varnado, where the deputies lived. And he was a suspect at the time, but he denied any knowledge of the crime. And when Irene was interviewed in 1965, she said, no, he was home with me all night long. So about 20 years later in 1965, this really strange thing happens. Well, I said 85. Let's get down to, say, a year or so after that. The FBI gets a phone call or a message from Irene Birch. And Irene Birch tells the FBI to come see her. Mm-hmm. And this is what has happened. Irene, according to her family and according to what she told the FBI, had been the victim of terrible domestic abuse by her husband throughout their marriage. But in 1985, her husband, James, had taken a bar stool at their home one night and knocked her to the floor, knocked her out. And for Irene, this was the last straw. And she determined she wasn't going to accept this anymore. She filed a complaint against him. Her husband was arrested, and the day of court came in 1985 at the Franklinton Courthouse. They're up on the second floor. The case is heard by the judge. The judge then rules, and the judge rules against Irene. Rules in favor of her husband, the case is dismissed. Irene is just distraught, devastated, can't believe this. She leaves the courtroom and leaves the courthouse. Her husband is escorted downstairs to the bottom floor. And as he and his attorney are going into the clerk of court's office, apparently to file some paperwork, Irene walks into the foyer of the courthouse, reaches into her purse, pulls out a revolver, and shoots her husband dead. Shoots him 4 or 5 times. Well, I say dead. He lives for a few hours, but then he dies.
Right.
Irene is convicted and sentenced to state prison at the women's facility at St. Gabriel. And it is there that she contacts and asks that FBI agents come see her. She also makes contact with Creed Rogers and tells him that she has something to tell the FBI. The FBI comes, and Irene says, I lied to y'all in 1965. She said, my husband, I was afraid of him, that he had actually left that night in his truck that had, and came back the next morning, walks in and tells me that those two black deputies, didn't say it that nicely, but those two black deputies wouldn't be bothering anybody anymore, apparently at that time thinking that both of them had been killed. She said that, like McElvin, her husband had sideboards on the back of his truck, that he burned the sideboards that morning, and wow, that he burned his Klan robe. And then he told her, if you ever open this mouth, your mouth about this, I'll kill you. And Irene said she was afraid of her husband, and she was afraid of the Klan. And as she told the FBI, she said, I'm telling you this to clear my conscience. My husband's dead. I killed him. Y'all won't be able to do anything to him. But I just wanted to know you to know that I lied to you, and that's what he told me. One of Birch's daughters told me that before this happened, a year or so, that she had asked her daddy one day, said, Daddy, did you help kill that deputy? And first of all, she asked him, did he know McElvin? Well, he did know McElvin. And she said, did you kill those deputies? And he said, no, I was in the other truck. And that statement had great significance to me because it confirmed what the FBI had long known, is that this was a military-type operation that involved two pickup trucks and a car. And my take on it was that whichever pickup truck got in position first would be the one that shot at the two deputies, and it just happened to be McElvin's. We know a car was involved because a salesman from Florida who was traveling through Varnado about that time got stopped on the outskirts of town and held there for a minute or two by this man with in his car. He could tell the man had a whip antenna radio in the back of the car. It wasn't a police car. And he says, well, that man stopped him to keep him, I guess, passing on by town or through town. At that moment, that salesman heard those shots go off. He could hear the shots in which the deputies were being killed, which confirms the fact that there were three vehicles involved that night, including Mr. Birch's vehicle and Robert Rester, the city attorney, was in one of those two trucks apparently as well that night. So the stories told by the wife, there's another similar example told by an ex-wife of another Klansman who was a key suspect, and she said basically she had lied to the FBI as well, telling them that her husband had been with her all night when in fact he had not. And when he arrived, he said something very similar about those two black deputies won't be bothering anybody anymore. And she literally left him the next day. And and that man, her husband, also left town with another man, and he was the other man said that this suspect was looking over his shoulder the whole time as they went to Oklahoma, and this man couldn't get out of town fast enough.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these commercials. You talk about this man, I believe you're talking about Wilford Moore.
Yes, yes.
Let's talk about these suspects and how FBI get around to this suspect list, how they make the connection, what is... obviously, the Klan is the connection, but connect all of these people, as the FBI does, and you do in your investigation.
Well, you connected by, you know, the process of elimination and who knew who and who was. So what you basically have was a group of Klansmen from Varnado, the town where the deputies live, and a group of Klansmen from Bogalusa, who many of them had become Klan outcasts, who had been kicked out of the Klan for their violent tendencies. Wilfred Moore was one that had been kicked out because he just couldn't get enough. He just wanted to be violent all the time. Some of the suspects in Varnado just never would tell the FBI the truth. There were two or three different men in Varnado, Bobby Lane, Archie Roy Seal, who were brothers-in-law. The FBI caught them in repeated lies, but these guys would just never tell the truth. And the interesting thing is that the FBI did surveillance on McElvin and some of these suspects for decades and decades and decades. And you just couldn't get the eyewitness, the one person to say, yes, you know, if the two witnesses in Varnado, if Jesse Bell Thigpen or Scraps Fournier could have just said, that's no question, that was Ray McElvin's truck. I mean, I think that would have been strong, or if they just recognized anybody else. And apparently, you know, as I mentioned, those deputies, when the truck passed them two or three times that night, I mean, when they saw the truck two or three times, apparently the other shooters were hiding, either laying down in the back, which I would suspect that they were doing, because that was a really small pickup truck that McElvin had. Obviously, McElvin would have been driving his own truck. I don't think it was an old pickup, kind of hard to handle. And obviously, he could not drive that truck and fire a shotgun and a high-powered rifle at the same time. So they know at least three people were in the truck that did the shooting. Could have been more, but at least three. But there was just never that one witness who could positively say, yes, I saw so-and-so fire this shot. Wilfred Moore, circumstantially, there was a witness that said when Wilfred was trying to get out of town, doing everything he could, a day or two after this happened, he was ready to run, that this man said he came to my house, he was unloading possessions that he owned to try to raise money to get out of town. And the man said, I looked through the bathroom window and I saw Wilford take an M1 Tanker Garand high-powered rifle and lean it against the tree. And he says, the man inside the house said, I went back and did some other things, came back, looked out the window again, and that rifle was gone. Apparently he had sold it. The FBI looked for those weapons, could never find them. They looked for those sideboards that they suspect were possibly burned at some time that night. Could have taken them and threw them into that fire that was burning on the highway there towards Angie, north of Varnado. Don't know where. They could never figure out what happened to the sideboards. And to the credit of the FBI, everything they looked for, in 2007, after Moore's wife told them what her husband had left the house that night, she mentioned that he had a cache of this hole covered by a concrete block on the back in the house that the weapons were stored in. And so in 2007, the FBI go to that house. Of course, they're gone. They're not there anymore. The new family is there, and they dig up that concrete block, and they find no weapons. So what I think is that the men involved in this project were hardcore men, that they had a lot of hatred in their heart, but they had one key thing that criminals have, and that's good criminal or successful criminals have, and that is the ability to keep their mouth shut. And McElvin, through all of his life, he may have privately had a conversation with family. He never would be interviewed by reporters. He never said publicly anything about that. The only word he would put out that he didn't do it. And I always wondered, well, meaning that I didn't do it, did that just mean that I didn't fire the shots that did it? Maybe I was driving the truck, so maybe, you know, don't know. It's all speculation, but these were people, the people involved in this, other than you say, well, what about Rester, the city attorney? Yeah, his alcoholism got him in trouble, but it also became a problem for the FBI, who could say this man, even when we gave him a lie detector test that he failed,
right,
he was so drunk the day we gave it to him, we can't really say this works, and how are we going to get him on, you know, a defense attorney will tear us up. But I say that, in my opinion, I think the Justice Department should have rolled the dice on a couple of these men and just tried it anyway and take a chance to lose it. And, you know, because they had some very compelling, you know, confessions, tape confessions,
right,
ex-wives, widows, just too much good stuff there that I think could have resulted in a conviction.
You write that in December 65, the Grand Dragon, Charles Christmas, abolished that Saxon farmer's title as Grand Titan, second in command. Is there some significance, and is this some testament to the sort of the division between some clan members and some of these people?
Absolutely. And if you think it was... You had in September of 65 the big court case in New Orleans where the Klan members were identified, and where you had Klan members now seeing that their leaders had sold them out. And you also had this, you have this continuous thing that happens within the Klan that these are divisions over leadership. And so Charles Christmas had been forced to testify. He apparently, from what I can tell, was not involved in any way in the murder of O'Neill Moore. However, it was this constant bickering between he and Saxon Farmer over control, and I think he wanted to get away from Farmer, and Farmer wanted to go even more militant. You know, Farmer was the kind of guy that accused him of something, he doesn't care. He'll do something else just to prove he doesn't fear you, you know, that nobody's going to stop him. And that's what, by 65, that's what you really had in Bogalusa and Washington Parish, with nothing but these hard, hardcore men. I mean, 66 and on. And the numbers just continued to dwindle. But Farmer was involved in the Klan through the 1970s. He was constantly involved.
You
and
read about some
men
other...
that...
Go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was just going to say that, you know, he's just the example of the hardcore, hate-filled, just willing to die, preserve white supremacy and segregation. He just, by George, is not going to live a life in which a black has any control or say in what he does, and he doesn't want to mix with black people, and he doesn't feel they're qualified to serve an office in the United States. And basically, he feels that all blacks should be, you know, shipped back to Africa. That's his attitude. And he died by that.
Yeah. You write about the change in attitude eventually in the area, in terms of people accepting, the whites accepting, and even people that would consider themselves Klan accepting the reality of the civil rights movement, that these laws of segregation were to be ended.
Yeah, so what you had by the, particularly by the 1970s, was, you know, men like David Duke rose up during that time, and they sort of had this new modern Klan idea. Okay, so look what the federal government did during the 60s. Now we have forced busing, which had become a critical thing that a lot of white people opposed, particularly in cities. It was a big issue of the busing issues. So what they capitalized then on was they realized, well, civil rights is here, so how do we combat it now? And so there was this newer Klan that was simply trying to figure out ways to keep the races separated. And, you know, and they would use issues like busing, which were divisive issues, to keep their keep a white following intact. And again, you know, what does David Duke live by? He lives by being provocative and reaching out to that hardcore element, or those people that support it silently, you know, for money. Mm. That they support him financially. And then politicians will like people, some would like people like Duke because he takes that issue and helps get them support. So it's a constantly a new issue, you know, as time passes on. But yeah, white people, you know, people have to understand white people by and large were not violent, and they didn't condone the violence, but their silence sort of was not a good thing because, you know, they didn't get involved. But white people were just as afraid of these Klan criminals as black people were. And a lot of people don't know this, but the Klan also targeted a lot of white men, mostly poor white men, many alcoholics, many that had trouble sustaining their families. And, you know, and so the Klan was going out, these vigilantes going out on these nighttime raids of homes and stuff and hurting people. And in an era when there's no cell phones and in an era when there's no GPSs on your car, you could literally get by with things that you can't get by with today. And that's another reason in Washington Parish you have lonely dirt roads, graveled roads, forest, and the Klan was literally invisible until they showed up at your door to burn a cross or to hurt you. So that's a real fear. And a lot of people at that time didn't have phones in their home. Many people didn't have cars. So very isolated time, a different time at which a Klan could work really effectively.
Yeah, certainly. I want to thank you very much, Stanley, for coming on and talking about this incredible book, Klan of Devils, The Murder of a Black Louisiana Deputy Sheriff. Please tell our audience the other book regarding this subject that you are an author of, and if there's a way that people might take a look at your other work, website, Facebook page, etc.
Yes, all of the stories that I wrote over the years about Klan cases, particularly in northeastern Louisiana and southwest Mississippi, are online on the Concordia Sentinel. All of those stories are there. My first book was called Devil's Walking. It was about the rise of the Silver Dollar Group, which really were a group of traditional, a group of men belonging to traditional clans who grew dissatisfied with those clans, such as the original Knights. And they go underground, and they're led by a man who does the recruiting. His name is Red Glover. And when he recruits someone to his underground clan within a clan, he gives them a silver dollar minted in the year of their births, and that becomes their token. They don't wear robes. They don't have rallies. They don't burn crosses. They simply go out and commit violence, and their unity is through that silver dollar. And it's about, that book covers 8 murders that I link to the Silver Dollar Group.
Wow. Well, thank you so much, Stanley Nelson. Klan of Devils, The Murder of a Black Louisiana Deputy Sheriff. Thank you so much. You have a great evening. Thank you so much for this interview.
Thank you, Dan. My pleasure.
Good night.